You're listening to Coach Your Brains Out by Gold Medal Squared. This is part two of our conversation with Wade Gilbert on engineering your environment, and we also get into some talk on youth sports. Enjoy. Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen. Can you think of any examples of, I guess, how some of those high-level coaches have fostered trust between them and their athletes?
Yeah, and there's an activity Jonathan actually did with his team after I shared it with him, and you may have seen it too, the Triple H activity. Have you seen this one? Hero Hardship Highlight?
No.
I don't think so.
Yeah, just you could Google that. Hero Hardship Highlight, John Gordon, J-O-N. He's the guy who wrote The Energy Bus and lots of other books. But he has a little, and I came across it actually in Australia. A pro team that won a championship over there in Australian rules football had come across it, and they used it, and they felt it was critical in terms of, they actually wrote a book about their season, and that was actually in the book. And what it is you share, each person on the team shares a personal hero, a personal highlight, and a personal hardship. And there's lots of different ways to do it, but it's got to start with the coach, right? So the coach will share the three H's. And I think when Jonathan did it, he had one athlete per session, as opposed to trying to do it in 2 or 3 hours with everybody, because it gets really emotional and it gets heavy. So a simple little activity like that builds connection. It, you know, you have to be vulnerable. So if I want you to be vulnerable, I'm going to model it. So I'm going to go first. I'll start it. And you don't want to put people on the spot. So give them some time to process it and prepare for it. So, I mean, there's another guy who actually has done a lot of really neat stuff in terms of team building and trust, a guy named Jeff Jansen. Have you ever come across him?
No.
Yeah, Jeff Jansen. He Jansen Sport Leadership. You could Google him, or if you follow up after, I could send you some links. But that's what he does for a living, and he's been really, really successful. He works with lots and lots of college teams. You know, he has a master's degree from Cal State Fullerton, so he has a background in this area in terms of understanding the science and whatnot. And he makes his living applying this. So he's got courses and curriculum and books and all kinds of neat stuff out there.
Nice. We got some homework to do.
You do.
I like it. I like homework. So what do you do in a situation, let's say, you know, you have an athlete who's really like living out your team's values. You know, we want to trust each other, and they go above and beyond, and they're vulnerable with their teammates. They trust them. But they're maybe a lower level athlete, and you have to prioritize your time as a coach, and you you know, put your feedback and a lot of your time and energy into the players who are going to be on the court. So I guess how do you show that you value that person who's, you know, an important member of the team, but you're just not able to spend the same amount of time with?
Yeah, so you could assign them some other roles in terms of how they contribute to the team. Whether that's administrative, coaching, support. So you kind of draw them in and give them some important assignments to help them understand and see that you really value their contribution to the team and what it takes to be a great team. I remember a funny story when Coach Wooden recruited a guy named Sven Nader. Do you know that story?
No, I know Sven Nader, but
yeah,
good story.
So I've known Sven for probably 15 years now, but he's so at the time, Coach had Bill Walton, and who became widely regarded as maybe the best college center ever. And his recruiting pitch to Sven was, "Want to come play at UCLA? You will never start a game. You may not even play any games, but you're going to become one of the best centers in college basketball, but you'll never start a game. I'm telling you right now, and you probably won't play much at all." And his job was, said, "Your job is to make Bill Walton the best college center ever." And, you know, he fought it for a little bit, but he did buy into it. And he's the only player, I think, still to this day, who never started a college, who was drafted into the NBA from college and never started a college game.
Wow.
Yeah. And he had a 10-year career in the NBA. He was a great, great player. But so helping them, you know, defining their role, role clarity is a big topic I see with great teams. Don't assume anything. So really help people understand what their role is and that roles are fluid. So your role at the moment, this is what we need from you, and this is where I see it. Now that, you know, for sure that can change, right? And things often do change. Recognizing them. So, you know, really making an effort to, there's actually a book called Catch Them Being Good, written by Tony DiCicco. He was our Women's World Cup soccer coach a while back, and with a sports psychologist, Colleen Hacker. And, you know, that the principle there is look for people who are modeling those values. And it's easy as coaches, you know, the things that catch your eye are the skill things and the really skillful players making great plays. But can I really make a conscious effort to look for people who are modeling our values and then recognize it? So how do I recognize when people are doing the things we're asking them to do? Are there formal recognition ceremonies? Are there just, you know, informal call outs? Are there, you know, like in football, you got stickers for your helmets. I've seen, you know, lots of different examples, player of the week, practice player of the week, practice, you know, player of the day, just, but they're formals. They're formally built into the environment. So that's another way you kind of structure the engineer the environment. So if these things are really important, I'm going to make a point of making sure that we recognize those things. And one of my favorites was I was at Michigan State last year or the year before doing an event, and they have historically had a really great ice hockey team. I think 3 national championships, winningest coach of all time, coach there. And I was looking in their trophy case, and they had, you know, all the standard awards, season end of season awards, MVP, best defensive player, top rookie, all that kind of stuff. And they had another award, same size as all the other awards, same format, everything. And it was called the Goofus Award. And it's an award right up there beside MVP and top scorer, given out to the biggest goofball on the team every year. And you would think, why would they have an award for that? Well, one of their values is, you know, we're trying to do really hard things, but we never want to forget that we play hockey. We don't work hockey. This should be fun. There's got to be some joy in this. So the guy who helps bring that joy to the team, he's going to get recognized. He's getting the same award as the guy at the MVP.
That's great.
What feeling should you try to engineer for in the locker room post game? Let's say you had a tough loss. I guess, how do you recommend coaches create, like, what's that environment feel like? What should they be saying, as well as maybe in practice the next day?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because generally routines are really valuable. So win or lose, we follow the same protocol, same process in terms of who speaks and when they speak and how we do cool down and everything else. So it kind of, it just normalizes the experience and kind of keeps people from getting too high or too low. And it's another game. It's just, at the end of the day, it's another game. But having said that, as a coach, you know, great coaches are really good at, they have high emotional intelligence. So they're good at reading their players and understanding what they need in different moments. And I've had coaches, you know, design big speeches that they wanted to use before a game or after a game, and they didn't end up using them. And they say, you know what, the moment was the message. I didn't need to say anything there. Or another athlete on the team can be that message, right? It doesn't need to be the coach leading that all the time. But in general, routines and protocols are really valuable. In fact, we did another study on intermissions with NCAA championship ice hockey coaches. And they all were very consistent in terms of the routine that they used in those intermissions between first and second period and second and third period. And so it didn't matter if they're up 10-0 or down 10-0, they followed the same. Now they followed the same routine, but you know, the emotion or the wording of the message may have been different at times. But then I also have seen a lot of value in using, is not necessarily the right word, giving ownership of those moments to your players, to your team. And that's where your leaders really have to play a role. So whether you have captains or a leadership group or, you know, whatever you do that, they need to have ownership of that. That really, it's, you know, it's their experience. It's not our experience.
And just to clarify, are you saying the routines would be like, this is our routine when we lose, this is our routine when we win? Are the routines the same?
No, same routine. Same routine. This is what we do. You know, we shake hands, we gather, we huddle up, you know, whatever. Just it's just the same. And for sure, the emotions come into play. We'll be angry, we'll be excited, whatnot. But we go about our business. But you want to make sure that you do have. That's where I think being able to read your team, in terms of knowing, you know, when to intervene in a sense. That's where you don't need to be the one on your own doing that, though. That's, you know, in consultation with staff. What do you see? What do you think? What do you think right now? So kind of planning that out, and having those sounding boards, you know, bouncing ideas off senior leaders and team captains and stuff like that. But generally, you'd want to have kind of a set routine. So you have a pregame routine, you have a postgame routine.
Right. That's great. So we wanted to finish with some youth sports coaching questions, as I know you've been involved in that as well.
Sure.
So I was wondering what you would say the biggest goal of any youth coach should be.
To win the championship, man.
Of course. Come on,
dude. Well, yeah, I've had some interesting experiences, I'm sure, as anyone would, if you have kids. I have kids 16 and almost 16, 13 right now, and I've coached baseball and soccer and ice hockey and unfortunately, this is again where environments dictate behaviors. So our environments in youth sport in North America, we have leagues, we sign kids up 5, 6, 7, whatever, right? And then we put them on a team, and then there's a league, and there's a score, and there's referees, and there's playoffs, and there's, you know, all that. So we're engineering an environment that pretty much forces a volunteer youth sport coach to coach to winning, because that's what we measure. what gets measured matters. What do we measure? The only thing we measure pretty much that I've seen in youth sport is wins and losses. We don't measure character. We don't measure confidence. We don't, like, we have the four C, we call them the four C's. It's the foundation for athlete outcomes. And it's competence, confidence, connection, and character. Those are the four things you really want to, those are your targets. Those are the things, to me, that's, and this is what we have as a foundation in our U.S. Olympic Committee coaching framework. You're doing a good job. You've won, in a sense, as a coach. If your kids are more competent, confident, better character, and have a connection, so better teammate, let's say. So better player, a little bit more mentally tough, a better teammate, and a better person. If they come out of your season even a little bit enhanced in those four areas, you won. I don't care if you went 0-10, 0-20, but that's me, and that's what the research says, and that's what the literature, what people advocate who work in youth sport. But that's not what happens on the ground, because that's not the environment we've created. We don't measure any of those things, and we don't train any of those things. We don't train typical youth sport coaches how to teach any of those things. So it's asking a lot. So, for example, in countries like Norway, Scandinavian countries, Finland, in a lot of the European countries in soccer, like, they don't have leagues for kids under 12. They don't put them on teams. They don't have rankings for 8-year-olds and tournaments. They play. They play in clubs. They have play dates and they have practices, but they don't care about who wins at 12. They care about winning the world championships or the World Cup, right, or the Olympics, and they want lots of people in the pool. So they just change the environment. The most progressive sport I've seen here in the U.S. that I'm familiar with anyways is ice hockey with USA Hockey. So they, and a guy named Ken Martell actually is one of their directors of coach education, and he was just recognized just a few weeks ago by the U.S. Olympic Committee for all his work. And he wrote an article for a journal, the International Sport Coaching Journal, that I edit, that I'll send through to you. And it outlined, it was a 10-year experiment. Basically, they said, we have a toxic culture, parents fighting and, you know, at games, kids quitting at young ages, just everything that's wrong with youth sport. He said, we got to do something. So they changed the environment. And one of the things they did was they eliminated national championships for under 12, I think under 14 as well. So there's no incentive. There's no incentive to stack teams and travel all over the country. There's no pot at the end of the rainbow. There's no reason to do it. There's no incentive. We're going to remove it. They changed for young kids under 8, maybe, they play cross ice. So instead of having 5, 6-year-olds, right, playing against each other on a full sheet of ice that's designed for adults, they said, let's have 3 games going at the same time across the ice. We'll put up little dividers. Kids can't raise the puck anyways. Put little dividers up, and you got, now you have, instead of 5v5 on a full sheet of ice, you have 3 games of 5v5 that are more suitable. The environment's more suitable to those kids. They get more touches on the puck. And now we have 30 kids at a time playing hockey. So they started to make some, and I've actually seen other leagues in Canada where the games, the way the games are scored, a typical ice hockey game, it's you get 2 points if you win, 1 point if you tie, and 0 if you lose. Well, they have 10 and 15 point scoring systems. So if you don't get any penalties in the game, you get 5 points. If you, you know, if you score a certain number of goals, you get points. If you win, actually win on the scoreboard the game, you get a certain number of points. So you could actually lose a game on the scoreboard, but win it because you won all these other things that are important that we value. So then guess what? Coaches are going to coach to that. If I know we're getting points, if we don't get any penalties, you can be pretty sure coaches are going to put a lot of time and effort into making sure their kids play clean and don't mouth off to the ref and don't get penalties.
I love that idea, just changing the scoreboard. I have my first experience with this. I'm coaching my daughter's 6-year-old basketball team. And, you know, my whole goal is just to get the kids to want to play next year and
totally,
you know, play a lot of basketball. And but I've had these, I can empathize with why this happens, but I've had these parents come up to me after, like, you know, this dad, like, you know, I've got this idea for your offense. You know, you put the weakest players over here and you just,
sure, yeah,
you know, most of them don't know which direction we're going. And, you know,
I'll give you another example. One of my favorites, everything happens for a reason, but, I was coaching Little League baseball here. I think they were 9 years old, 8 or 9. And I'm by no means an expert baseball player, but knew enough to coach 8-year-olds. And it was just, you know, local baseball, and we hadn't won a game. I think we were 0-6 or something. And the commissioner of the league called me up in the middle of the day one time. I thought, oh, this is odd. Maybe just wanted to chat. And I said, so he proceeded to say, he said, so when are you going to start trying to win? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, you guys haven't won a game yet, and I've seen your games and some of your games, and like, it doesn't look like you're trying to win. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I saw you put so-and-so to pitch a couple innings, and I saw you put this other kid on first base for a few innings. He said, yeah, they're learning how to play.
Right.
So, yeah. Sure, I could put the biggest kid on first base for every game, the whole game, and yeah, we might win some more games, but I'm going to lose 10 kids next year who don't ever want to play baseball again because it's no fun.
Right. That's great.
Yeah, I guess this fits into maybe the competency part of the C's, but how important is it for these youth athletes to be learning the fundamentals and strategies of their specific sports?
Yeah, definitely. So we have in the U.S. something called the American Development Model, or ADM, which is basically designed around the long-term athlete development model, or LTAD. And depending on the stage of development, would kind of influence what the priority should be. So, you know, honestly, first exposure to sport, like you said, the real win is if they're coming back next year. So honestly, even, I mean, it might sound ridiculous, but part of me doesn't even really care if they get better. I want them to come back. So really that first exposure to sport, let's say six, you know, five, whatever, I just want them to love volleyball. I want them to be asking their mom and dad, when can I do volleyball again? When can we go back to volleyball? And the skills will come because, you know, especially if they all mature at different rates. And but I think for sure you do. What are the foundational skills that are going to help them if they do want to continue to play volleyball later in life? Agility, balance, coordination, right? Like those are foundational skills. So I think honestly, under 8, maybe 10, I don't know. I want better athletes. I want kids who are athletic. I want athletic kids. So if they're getting, we call that physical literacy, which you probably come across before. But that idea, I want kids who are physically literate so that they can play any sport. They could pick up any sport. And then definitely, you know, there comes a point where you have to spend more time on techniques and tactics and things like that.
Yeah, I actually just came across an article this week with that physical literacy, and I'd never heard that term, but I love that concept, and that stuck with me. So yeah. I have a 1 hour practice a week with my daughter's team. We have it this Sunday. What would you do if it's a basketball team? If you had an hour with these 6 and 7 year olds, what would your practice look like?
Well, think about it this way. Why are they coming to practice? They want to play basketball. At that age, they don't know it. They're not waiting for Sunday morning hoping they get to work basketball. Man, I can't wait for the drills we're going to have on Sunday. Their main motivation is, we know from 50 years of research, kids play sports because, number one, they want to have fun. Number two, they want to be with their friends. And number three, they want to get better at that sport. So if you have those three elements in a practice, you're winning. Are they having fun? Did they get to have fun with their friends? And are they getting a little bit better at basketball? So it should be almost, you know, from an outside perspective, I'm sure you'll get it anyways, but someone who's not as familiar with these things as you are, it will look kind of chaotic. Like, what is going on out there? Because there'll be lots of motion, lots of movement, it'll be messy, you know, lots of balls, every kid getting lots of touches on the ball, little games, like little mini games, like make it game-like. And no one should ever be sitting on a bench at that age in an hour practice. They have to be, they're coming to play, not sit on a bench. So you got have stations, have mini games, 2-on-2, you know, 2v1. They love, if think about it this way, if kids showed up to a basketball to the gym, and last minute they were told, oh, coach can't make it, but you still have the gym. Someone will be here to supervise. Here's the balls. What do you think that would look like? What would the kids do?
Yeah, actually, I like to do that, and I try to let the first 5 to 10 minutes and to see what they do.
Yeah,
and they end up picking up a ball, dribbling it, throwing it at the hoop. You know, some of them don't even pick up a ball; they kind of just talk and play little games, clapping sure. hands. But yeah, I love to observe that and see what they do and have some unstructured play.
So we call that free play, right. And that's fantastic. The first, I agree. You know, the first, I used to do that with little kids with soccer. The first 5-10, well, depends how long your practice is, right? But there's some space in there to let them be kids. Go play.
Right.
Go around. Get it out. Like, they don't need to do laps and all that kind of stuff. Like, that could be the warm-up. Go play. All right? and then you can have some structure. But again, it's make it as game-like as possible and lots of touches. Like U.S. soccer, for example, they have a policy now with kids, you know, it's all about touches. Every kid should have a ball on their foot almost, you know, the whole practice if possible. And none of this one ball, 10 kids in a line, dribble through some cones. That's not why the kids are there. It's boring. They're not getting any touches. They got to move.
So I'm hoping maybe my next practice, you can come do a little session for my parents. You can talk to them. Well, that's, the kids are having a great time.
Yeah, this is what's going to happen. You're going to have the basketball dad or mom or whoever come and say, what the heck is this? This isn't training. Yeah, that's right. This isn't UCLA basketball. This is six-year-old's introduction to basketball. My job is to get them excited about basketball and come back next year. But it doesn't matter. You're still going to have people. And I have had parents, you know, I try to educate them in a sense. And I've had parents leave my team. Say, wow, did you know? I even had in soccer, I think they were six. And I said, you know what? We're going to go twice a week, which I think is dangerous. The league didn't have any guidelines on practice. It just, you know, you have a game on Saturday. What you do during the week's up to you. And so it was a free-for-all. And I said, okay, we're going to do twice a week for 45 minutes, you know. And afterwards, a parent came up to me and said, hey, well, I have a friend who has a kid on another team, and they've been practicing for 3 weeks, and they practice four times a week. I said, you know what? Everybody on this team has multiple siblings. They run around all over town for all different events. You're allowed to have dinner as a family once in a while. Okay, you don't have to be out all the time, and your kid will not fall behind, because I know all the research on athletic development. Okay, your kid's gonna be fine. But and I tried to explain it to her and research, and she never came back. She took her kid and went somewhere else. So, well, okay, what am I gonna do?
And they probably had a winning record.
Maybe they got a $2 medal in Oshibaki somewhere. Whatever, I don't know.
What does the research say about, or when do you recommend a youth athlete specialize in one sport?
Yeah, that's a hot topic for sure. And it really depends on the sport. So we have what we call early specialization and late specialization sports, right? So gymnastics, like it or not, you got to specialize early. You know, because if you're not getting in that pipeline early, if that's your goal, like if your goal is to, you know, be great at gymnastics, maybe make an Olympic team or something like that, figure skating, you know, that's just the nature of those sports. You got to do that early. Not saying that's healthy, but that's the environment, the reality of it. But generally, most team sports, you wouldn't want to specialize at least until high school, at least. Even if you could push it through high school and play multiple sports, that's ideal. But I know that's getting harder and harder. And there's some neat research on, there's actually a lot of research on that. But one of my favorites is one of my buddies from college did this research, and it was on there's an overrepresentation of professional athletes from small towns. Did you ever see that research?
No.
Yeah. So they replicated it around the world and in different sports. And so why? Like, what would it be? What is it about a small town that would lead to an overrepresentation of professional athletes? And one of the main things is they have to play multiple sports. If you're going to a high school in a little town out here in the valley and there's 300 kids in the high school and you're an athlete or like athletics, guess what? You're going to probably be playing three sports. And whether you like it or not, the coaches are going to want you to play and just to field teams, right? And so those kids get exposure to multiple coaches. They build resilience and mental toughness because they learn how to learn from different types of coaching and coaches. They physically and mentally, they don't burn out because they use different movement patterns, different playing surfaces. Maybe they're going from the pool to the court to the field, right? So there's tons of research to show mental, physical, cognitive, emotional benefits. And those are the players that most that college coaches love. They love multi-sport athletes because guess what? They're not blowing out their knee right away. They haven't had three surgeries on their shoulder already. They're healthier. They're more durable. And they have a better attitude and a better perspective. And they're not burned out on volleyball.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But I understand the nature of the game and the world we live in, especially with club sports. And it's, I actually, people expect me to say what I just said, but I was at an event one time and I said, well, you could have good specialization. I don't want to say specialization, early specialization is bad. Like if you got a kid who it's really clear, they love soccer and they just can't get enough soccer and you're doing everything to hold them back from soccer. I think, you know, what's wrong with letting them play soccer year round or most of the year if it's managed properly, right? Not playing 200 soccer games and traveling all over the country and they never get to spend any time with their friends. And but I think it depends on the kid and their stage of development and then also how it's managed.
Awesome. Well, Wade, so much great info. And I really like the idea of how we can tweak our environments at practice to get the most of our teams. And I know John got a lot out of it for his bumblebees or whatever his daughter's
team. The owls.
Yes. Go Owls.
Yeah, it's big game this week for the Owls.
Yes, they're all big games.
Oh yeah, they're all championship matches. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, thank you for coming on. Yeah.
But I just will finish too. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to give the impression that winning doesn't matter and competing doesn't matter and it should all be fun. I mean, learning how to win and learning how to lose is a really important life lesson, right? You guys mm-hmm. know it. So mm-hmm. yeah, there's nothing wrong with wanting to win and competing, but I always remind people, especially at that under 12, under 14 age, you know, you might win a game, but you might lose a kid. You know, so you win a game, but you lose a kid because those kids sitting on the bench never got a sniff, never got in. So, yeah, you won a game, but you lost three kids who are never going to play volleyball again, right? So what did you really win?
Yeah, I think your idea of the multiple scoreboard, you know, the scoreboard for, yeah, who scored more points, but we have these other things we value that we're tracking too. I think that seems like the right healthy mix. Love that
idea. Yeah, and also helping kids understand that, like, for example, playing time is, like anything in life, is earned. You don't show up and get a raise. You got to earn it. And so those are important lessons. Like, I'm coaching 11-year-olds right now, and we try and get every, you know, we do get every kid in every game in ice hockey, for example, but they don't all get equal playing time. We tell the parents that. It's competitive ice hockey. And yeah, they're 11. I get it. But they got to earn it. If they're not putting in good work ethic and practice and they haven't, you know, they haven't mastered the things we're expecting them to master, other kids are, they're not going to play as much. That's life.
Mm-hmm. Well, good stuff. Well, thanks, Wade. This was awesome. Appreciate so much of your time.
No, I feel like we're just getting started.
I know. We're locked in again if you're up for
round
it.
Round two, yeah.
We're doing more. So.
No, I appreciate the time and the opportunity to share and learn. And I'd love to keep sharing resources.
Cool. Yeah, please send over some of those articles you were referencing.
Sure, I will. Yeah.